Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, an unauthorized podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. The two ladies next to me are very giggly with their wine. So I'll tell you about our wine tonight. We are drinking a bottle of blackberry wine from St. Julian Winery in Michigan. I'm Cooper.
And I'm Miko, and this wine's delicious.
And I'm Ophelia. I concur.
It is delicious. So tonight we're talking about episode 5, Coquille.
Coquille.
It's directed by Guillermo Navarro, who was the DP on the first episode, and written by Scott Nimerfro, who becomes a recurring writer throughout this season and next season. Let's jump right in. We have an entirely metaphorical killer this week.
It ties much together.
We have some incredible imagery. We have the first legitimate tableau of the series. And things are bad all around, it seems like, for everybody involved in
things are taking a turn.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Turn for the worse here.
Well, I want to talk about Will specifically. This is really the darkest Will gets in Red Dragon. He has a hard time.
Yes.
But that's really it.
That's true. It's more of his the struggle with the memories. Mm-hmm. This is triggering memories. There's also, because Will doesn't have any connection to family in the TV series, like
except for the dogs. The dogs are his family.
But he has real human family.
He has people
in his life in the book, and he has some explaining to do with.
He has some splaining to do with this.
Hey, Lucy.
When his stepson finds out. So
yeah.
there's more, I guess, different devices in the book. So they're having to find new ones since the dogs can't really say, yo, you didn't tell me about this murder thing.
Uh-huh.
Though I'd like to see that. I mean, that takes us into Son of Sam territory.
Well, I mean, he's already imagining Winston is something that he's not.
Yes,
so it's
let's
a
talk
step
about
farther
that.
To have him actually talk to him.
Okay, so Ophelia, do you remember this from the first time we saw it?
I don't remember this scene from the first time
we watched
it. I looked
back at our Facebook posts, because that's how I cataloged my life. And I found where I mentioned that you and I were catching up on Hannibal, because we didn't start watching it immediately when it was on, because we thought... Why would NBC have a good show about Hannibal Lecter?
It couldn't possibly.
Why would NBC have a good show?
Let's instead watch Dexter steadily drive us off that cliff of caring. But so I found that we basically watched episodes 1 through 4 in a chunk.
Yes.
And then we were watching
regularly.
So I think that may be part of why, it's such a great metaphorical moment. And, you know, I've talked a lot about how much I care about the character of Winston, because Winston actually has character, whereas the other dogs are just kind of the pack.
And I think you kind of see him as your own dog. Who is actually in the room with us right now.
He is. He's looking away from us.
He couldn't care less that we're doing
this. No. He's asleep and he's got his head turned away.
Yeah.
But I feel like you definitely identified with Wilson so far.
Winston.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Wilson, I'm sorry.
With Winston early on, and I think it was because you're like, aw.
Well, Winston is adorable, but let's talk about it. We all know Winston's adorable. All the listeners would agree that
Winston's adorable,
except those non-dog people.
He's
all brindle. He's adorable. Yeah.
Okay,
but
moving on.
What we're talking about is the fact that we open with Will walking down a street, and it's the street where he found Winston, and he's being followed by the Raven Stag.
Yes.
And this is an interesting moment because the Raven Stag's actually interacting with him. You know, previously he's seen it across a field. You know, he's seen it around.
Hallway
but here it's nuzzling against him. And when he wakes up, and is being talked to by the police, we realize that it's Winston behind him. And so, you know, it gives us this new sort of perspective on what the Ravenstag is, what the Ravenstag represents. And I've always maintained that Winston represents the goodness in Will.
Ah, yes.
And, I mean, we haven't seen a lot of that, but you know, Will is... The first great thing we see of Will is Will taking care of this dog after we've seen him murder a family. It may have been in his head, but we saw him murder a family. So then we go to
Then
Winston.
We go to this and you see him doing something caring and loving.
Yes.
And
so we feel like, okay, he's a good guy. And I made that connection, but so now we have to pivot that and wonder if that's what the Ravenstag represents.
Ah, that Ravenstag is more of a positive imagery as opposed to negative.
Because overall, it has all the trappings of negative imagery.
Oh,
I mean, the raven has that. You know,
the raven is murder and death. And
it definitely looks ominous. And
The ravens is a murder.
Yes. A murder of crows. But there's very little difference between ravens and
We'll concede
size.
That. We'll,
ravens are... Ravens are very small compared to crows, right?
I think the only difference, the way you tell it, I know the difference between a raven and a crow is that a raven has a triangular-shaped set of feathers on their tail, and a crow is blunt.
Oh.
And I think the ravens are actually slightly bigger.
Oh, okay.
So here's a little bit of your... What's it, ornithological?
Ornithology.
Ornithology from your friends at Eat the Rootcast.
Now you know, that blackbird out on your lawn.
If you can get close enough and grab it and look at its tail.
Well, I think you could observe this from a distance.
Yeah. Well, you could, okay.
Yeah. But ravens, too, have that, because, quote, the raven nevermore, it's sort of historically has a connection to death. And I'm not sure whether it's sort of riding on the coattails of the crow having connections to death, where it, you know, it's supposed to help souls across. Crows are supposed to help souls across to the other side.
I think that's one of those things that I think was developed here. Watch me just judge the entire history of a mythology of a creature here, but so crows are carrion birds.
Mm-hmm.
They eat the dead.
That's very
so. If your son sees a loved one being eaten by crows out there, dead in the field, you'll say, "Oh no, the crows are just helping carry his spirit to the afterlife
by eating them.
It's those wonderful lies you always tell as a mom.
So I mean, moms throughout history have lied about crows, is what I'm saying. So I think that's a legitimate theoretical.
That is a legitimate. But to have something that does have a connotation of death or foreboding, or for it to have a positive connotation is very interesting.
And I think part of that can come from them talking about the deer and how beautiful it is and how honoring it is, whereas it was used as an implement of murder. It was not the implement of murder.
Right, that's true.
So, when he's speaking to the police, and the cop is asking him if he often sleepwalks, he says no, and he says he's not even sure he's awake now, which shows that he is still unsure of whether or not what's happening to him in that
moment
is real.
Yeah.
He's not sure what is reality, so he's got his own disconnect from wakefulness and I sleep.
Think this is the first time we've really started to encounter that type of uncertainty in Will.
Yes, this is the first time we've seen Will not sure of reality.
He's always, and that's true, he's always been very self-aware.
And of all the people to admit it to, a police officer.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
but it's a good thing.
I'd still be trying to
because
lie.
Because he's still in Wolf Trap, Virginia.
He is still.
So they can take him right home. And Will goes to Hannibal immediately.
Yes.
Like first thing in the morning to talk about
with
this.
With his wonderfully complicated coffee.
It's just all glass and it's almost science.
It does. It looks like it's a scientific
chemistry lab with a cock stop and everything.
Exactly. And it's
well, he would want the most elaborate and interesting. Like his teapot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
His glass teapot that he used to steep his mushroom tea last time.
Yeah. Psilocybin.
His mushroom tea. Exactly. Everything about him is about it being sort of beautifully complicated.
Mm-hmm. I get the feeling that if it doesn't intrigue him, he doesn't want it in the house.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not going to use something just for function. He wants it to be form. And we see the beginnings of Hannibal sort of wanting to isolate Will. You know, he's very curious about Will, and he's trying to isolate him from Jack here.
And I think it's funny because he states that. Yeah. Are you trying to...
Are you trying to...
Turn me against...
So I had to find out what a group of ravens is called. The initial answer was that a group of ravens is called an unkindness. But it says, depending on the activity of the group, it could be a constable of ravens, an unkindness of ravens, or a conspiracy of ravens.
I like that it's depending on their activity.
Apparently.
Because if they're being dicks, they'll be called an unkindness. If they seem to be doing something in a group to maybe bring down that animal in the clearing, then they could be a conspiracy. Oh. A constable is when they're upholding the law.
Apparently, it's when they've congregated around the Tower of London. Oh. They were thought to be keeping watch over the monarchy.
Okay.
Therefore, any time a grouping of these birds is called is called a constable. It says, but the unkindness or conspiracy, likely for similar reasons, is if a flock is driving off another predatory or carrion bird or picking on another species. Mm. I guess, you know, they're big, they throw their weight around. So they're an unkindness.
Or they're conspiring with the wolves.
Oh. They're trying to get, you know, they're bullying other animals to get to the carrion, apparently. So,
and there's
ravens are bullies.
Yeah, there's apparently there are plenty of carrion eaters, so they got to hold their ground.
And it is, and I was like, okay, I had to stop and share that because it is, it's like instead of the murder
kind of
crows,
people
we have
are.
The conspiracy. Or
you need to be accurate.
Yes, and there's so many levels of just. You know, everything in there with imagery and...
It's no accident these are ravens.
I want to go down that path to know how the raven and the stag is intertwined.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's dream logic. The first image Will gets is that girl impaled on the stag head being swarmed by ravens.
Yep. So then,
so he has combined those into his head into this creature,
right. Which at this stage of the game now looks more like a spirit animal than it does.
Yeah.
It does.
Anything as ominous as it seemed before, especially because it's linked to the dog, which is like a familiar. So things are trying to protect him. Which is really necessary now because he's not sleeping. He's sleepwalking. He's having nightmares. He's snapping at people.
Mm-hmm.
This is all really getting to him at this point. And then, oddly enough, having to talk to Hannibal over it over coffee.
And thinking that Hannibal's helping him.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Who directly poses the concept that he is not in control of his own body.
Yes. Yeah, he definitely bringing up the sleepwalking. Mm-hmm. This is
the first of, I think, two sleepwalking moments in the script, where the second one, he winds up on the balcony of his, on the roof of his house, with the dogs freaking out behind him. And it's unsettling to Will, especially, I think, because so many serial killers talk about blacking out before they do something. So he sees himself losing the core of his being in the same way that he has seen other killers lose it.
I think what's also great about him and the dogs is they brought up, especially I believe it comes up with in the dinner with Bella about animal cruelty being a hallmark of killers, of serial killers.
And dinner that Jack and Bella share with Hannibal, it's just... reeks of foreknowledge and thematic dialogue. You know, we have the cruelty is a gift man gives to himself line.
Yes.
That's that's like choosing to be cruel. That's what Hannibal chooses, whether or not he wants to be cruel when he kills people. He talks about the ethical butcher that he employs, and which tells us immediately that Hannibal, in general, when he kills people, he generally doesn't try to hurt them.
Right.
Because he wants the meat.
Yeah.
That said, we've seen in the movies what Hannibal does to people he doesn't like.
Like, yes.
And I get the feeling that there's a big difference between Hannibal eating the rude and Hannibal trying to find someone for tonight's dinner party.
Ah, I see. So the whether or not he cares or is angered or has the emotional connection he has with whoever the intended victim is. Because he can be unbelievably harsh and cruel and hurtful on purpose for people that he definitely does not like. But that whole connection to the ethical butcher idea.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And we're starting to get more glimpses of him as being...
As the monster.
The monster. Because they were still keeping that close to the vest. We all know, the many of us who have... Between Silence of the Lambs alone.
Well, it makes me wonder, is there anyone in the audience who doesn't know Hannibal Lecter is a monster?
I've wondered that every week.
Because this show
would... It's hard not to know.
It couldn't possibly...
I don't
be that
it.
Way.
No, I don't believe it.
Yeah. You'd have to live under a rock, basically, to not know.
But with that in mind, they're playing that game with us because we know.
Yes.
You know, it's not like they're actually trying to hide the nature of Hannibal Lecter. I mean, otherwise, seeing lungs in episode one wouldn't have been a joke.
Right.
It would have just been horrifying. But they went for the joke of it. They went for the gag. It's like, oh, he took a lung. Boom. Or, well, he's eating them. Boom, Hannibal.
Right. I think the tease is for us as the audience, is that they're sort of working on here is not whether or not we're going to find out that he's the killer. Because there's 99.99% of the audience should know that by now. Like I said, you have to have either lived under a rock or, have had no... didn't watch any movies at all in your entire life or read anything or hear anything if you did not know. So he knows we know, but it's basically what we're waiting and what we're on the edge of our seat is when will they know?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And when what will that do to this show around. We're watching?
Yes.
And I think of that often as the new watcher here, having, not seen a season and a half that comes. Mm-hmm. I keep thinking that, how long can they play this game? Because once we know, how does that change things?
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes when you have that long-awaited reveal or that long-awaited thing happen, it can ruin a show. You know, we've seen it in sitcoms, we've seen it in dramas, we've seen it,
So Hannibal getting arrested is the Ross and Rachel of the show?
Right, exactly. Wow. It's when Joey finally sleeps with Angela, the show is over.
When they're having coffee, Hannibal is telling Will that Jack is pushing him too hard, and he makes a comment that likens Jack to being the devil, which I thought was ironic, being that we know the monster that Hannibal is.
Well, it's fascinating also because later in the episode, Hannibal asks Will if he ever feels abandoned, specifically by Jack.
By Jack.
And it's followed up with the way gods abandon their creations. Mm-hmm. And so that's just so dense because Hannibal is that creator. He's winding people up and seeing what he can do with them. And so Jack is God on one hand and the devil on another.
Both at the same time.
Yes.
Because he's created something, but he's using it in a way that is not entirely...
And theoretically, Jack has created this version of Will, this version that Will desperately did not want to be. Yeah. And that's why he stayed just in his classroom. So actually, Jack and Hannibal are doing very much the same thing. They're having little regard for what Will actually is and wants.
They're changing him to suit their needs,
yeah.
Basically.
And Jack has said that in the previous episodes, that he will go with what suits his needs.
To stop a killer, he's going to stop at nothing. And even if it means destroying Will in the process.
He's a means to an end.
Yes.
And he's willing to sacrifice it. And there's also a lot of things on there where they talk about, also, is everything worthwhile if it stops another killing?
Mm-hmm.
And that comes up a lot. It comes up a lot here, and it's a slight theme in the books, too, of you carry so much guilt with each impending
death. If you know you could have stopped it just by hurting yourself a little bit.
Exactly. So
the concept,
or hurting someone else.
Do you throw a person on a train track
to
save the people who are on the
train? Well, that's right. Jack's conflict.
Yeah.
And
right.
We clearly see that Jack Crawford would throw as many people in front of the train track to save a greater number.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
Will is on board with that. Will knows, and it's brought up in this episode where Jack tells Will that you'll regret not being here, you know, the next time this happens, and you're there again on a job with a job as a diesel mechanic in a boatyard.
Or it'll sour his classroom
forever. Everything will be shitty at that point, just not being there. And it doesn't matter that Will thinks this is bad for him, and Will is very much aware that this is doing terrible things to him. And he is associating all that. It's like, okay, well, now I'm sleepwalking, and I can't remember stuff. And so it's really a destructive relationship that they have.
But I also thought that this brought up a very interesting connection between Will and Jack, at least this episode.
Because they're doing good?
No, because, for example, there's a part where Jack is speaking to the wife of the killer.
Yes.
And Will realizes that Jack has something really bad that he just realized in his mind. He saw Jack walk away, walk around his desk, sit down, and look shocked.
Which is interesting because Will is very much not able to really understand the emotions that he's seeing.
He seemed very intuitive.
But he understands that there's something wrong.
And
maybe that emphasizes their relationship at that point. Maybe that he knows Jack well enough
to know there's something wrong with Jack, and if something's wrong with Jack, it's got to be huge.
Also, yes. I mean, think about what he did. He stepped away from important information.
Mm-hmm.
He put himself in...
Stopped talking.
And in the process of, okay, we have a legitimate lead at this moment. We can go get this guy.
We know where this guy is.
But I'm going to sit and be with my own emotions for a little while. That's
huge.
A significant thing for Jack.
And when they first go to speak to the first family of the victim, it was very awkward for Jack to be in the presence, or for Will to be in the presence of the victim's family. He was just not together there. He was saying inappropriate things.
Right.
But in this scene, we see Will stand up and sort of take over what Jack would normally be asking. It's almost like he's mimicking
That thing that they mention in the book that Will develops the traits
of the people he's conversing with.
So he did suddenly perform very much like Jack.
Asking the same questions that Jack would ask, posing the questions to get the information.
I didn't even pick that up. That was great.
That's true.
Gets that information, and then he's like, let's go.
Even when he becomes aware of it, he can't stop doing it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's his coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. It's, I don't understand emotion, but I can give you back what you've been giving me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I can mimic your...
It's this layer of artificiality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's slide then into, because we brought up Jack's emotional moment here, and this takes us into the time we spend with Bella, played by Gina Torres here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dinner between Jack and Hannibal and Bella, which is full of these wonderful little discussions about cruelty to animals. But it's also, it accompanies this overwhelming sadness in the performance by Gina Torres that we still aren't certain what that is at that point.
Right, we don't know at this point. It's interesting because she's not exactly uncomfortable to be there, but she's very distant. And I think, you know, we just sort of take it as because we've seen the slight distance between them before.
And we feel like, okay, probably an affair.
Right, or something like that. Right. There's something going on here. Yeah. They're putting on a show for, you know, for Hannibal.
Because he keeps insisting. Asking to put her on the table.
Yeah. Right.
And in this...
he keeps subtly making weird cannibal jokes. Will you please, Bella, just come to dinner so he'll shut up about this.
Yeah, right. He keeps asking me. I'm getting embarrassed.
He wants to have you for dinner, like, all the time.
All the time. Just come on.
Then Jack gets a little amorous. It's like, I don't blame him. I'd like to. And she's just like, no, not tonight. Just shuts him down. Or just rolls over.
She just rolls over.
Makes or the, even better, reaches the, over, turns his light off, and then rolls over.
Makes the chasm between them just a little bit bigger by pushing the pillows farther apart.
Which, right. Now I feel bad because we're joking about her cancer.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
so Bella has cancer. Yeah.
What I found very interesting about that reveal later on is that in this richly colored scene, you have Hannibal's exquisite dining room. We're still echoing the show's sapphire blue themes and the walls and the interesting reds and everything that come up. It's reds and whites on the table. Both Jack and Hannibal are in their classic jewel tone blues with little bits of red, and in walks Bella in white.
In pure white, and how she stands out in that entire sequence. It's stunning. Mm-hmm. She looks like completely different from everything else in the room.
And we've never seen that.
No, we haven't.
We have never, there's never
everybody who sits at Hannibal's table
matches.
Sort of, conforms to that dining room.
Yes. Usually
it's a magical place.
Yeah. Or even the other characters that they have, it's either a pattern or a print or it's washed out like the topes of Will. Mm-hmm. Never a bright white.
Yeah. No.
And it was really interesting to have her come in as kind of angelic in this dress. And then
angels.
Yes, in a show about angels. Exactly. And a show about cancer. Because our killer has cancer. And
I didn't realize that she was dressed like an angel in a show about angels. So dense.
Told you, dense, layers, layers.
But I think it was interesting right before the scene ends.
The dinner scene.
Yes, right before the dinner scene ends, it is for all of maybe 3 seconds. There's a point where what leads up to Hannibal telling Jack that he once knew that a teacher had stomach cancer.
He smells
Bella first. That kind of creepy, lean over to get your plate and I whiff you.
Yeah.
And she gets all...
She knows.
Tight. Her shoulders get tight and she's just like, what is this man doing?
When he covers it by talking about her perfume.
Yes.
He does cover it, but which before he covers Hannibal. It, he does have a look on his face of like a pained concern. Then he switches over to the, I'm noticing what perfume you're wearing, and it's lovely.
I was watching Bella's face, because she had a lot going on there, because she could sense
it. Yeah, she was just like...
It was really uncomfortable.
She's very aware of
and then
and so we're specifically supposed to connect that, that he smelled his teacher's cancer, and that he could smell Bella's cancer, at least smelt something is wrong with Bella. Especially since Bella has lung cancer. So I imagine that is something, if you're going to smell cancer, something that's coming out when you breathe.
Of your breath.
Probably a noticeable
stomach smell. Also, I mean.
Stomach, yeah. Stomach. Very true.
But it would definitely come out there. I love how he describes her cologne as the smell of... was it light?
The earth.
Similar to the aroma on the air just after lightning strikes.
The air after a rainstorm is one of my favorite smells of all time. So to have a perfume described that way was particularly significant. And it sort of goes on about how he's trying to cover it. He makes it sort of a little flirtatious in the process to deflect mm-hmm. what he's doing. And it's so funny when Jack is like, well, he, you know, talks about how charming he
is. And it's a great parlor trick.
It's a great parlor trick, exactly.
Well, and it's great because it indicates that Hannibal is an information gatherer. Mm-hmm. Because information is so much power, especially information on the head of the FBI's Behavioral Science Division, who very well may someday be chasing
him. After him, yeah. He's gathering all he needs. After he charms her with the perfume, he mentions the cancer. Jack is completely unaware of what's going on.
Oh, yeah. This is going way over Jack's head.
But Bella and Hannibal have a moment.
Well, Jack's still in this. Look how cool my friend is.
Yeah. Look at all this. Yeah.
Look at this house.
Look at this house. He's going to cook food for me.
I know you didn't want foie gras, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I thought this was awesome.
One of those, this is my friend.
Yeah, kind
of
my friend.
Yeah.
Aren't you glad you came?
You don't
dinner?
Have to like
Aren't
it.
Aren't you glad? No. Aren't you're glad. You're happy.
Exactly. But it is so interesting to have that sort of, you know, that sort of, yeah, he's charming and especially since they're having relationship difficulties and they're not talking.
When we follow that to their relationship difficulties, where we're again in their bedroom.
Yes, and the all blue bedroom.
They're having this conversation where Jack does this thing, which is very sort of manipulative. I respect you enough to not ask if you're having an affair.
Yes.
Which is basically, if you are having an affair, you should feel extra bad because I respect you enough to know that you would never do
you
that.
You never do that.
So if you are doing that, oh my God.
Right. I wouldn't have ever
and
imagined.
Bella brings that up with Hannibal, that he said that mm-hmm. when she goes to visit Hannibal. So it's again, there's very much tension between the two of them. But Jack is trying to give her the space she needs to figure it out. He is aware of how difficult he is.
Yeah.
And he is a difficult man to know, to be around, to be friends with. I think that's why he likes Hannibal so much, because Hannibal seems to enjoy his friendship.
Yes. And probably doesn't relate to him the way everyone else does as the overbearing boss.
Very true. Yeah, because he's not actually Hannibal's boss.
The episodes that we've seen, everyone has that little bit of fear of him because he can, you know, bring the hammer down at any moment. And people run. You see it later on when Will speaks up.
Oh,
I didn't think he was very sharp or disrespectful. But techs scattered like rats.
All he said was, "If you don't like my opinion, you know, you go right ahead and have your own head of the behavioral department.
Yeah. He'd come up with your own.
Yeah, he turned the dad voice on, and everybody scurried.
I did not hear that
exactly. It's the way kids do when the one kid, you know,
yes, exactly.
talks back to parents, and everyone just scatters. Everyone hides because they don't want to get caught in the crossfire.
Well, I think it's nice, though, that Will is no longer really under the sway of that dad voice. He's just like, okay, fine.
Whatever.
And
no, I didn't say that. I'm sorry. Whatever. So Bella has two therapy sessions in this episode with Hannibal.
Yeah.
And
comes in white.
In both of them.
Yeah. A beautiful sapphire blue coat over the white when she first comes in, which I thought was interesting. I don't know whether that's her bridging into the other world, into this, you know. There's so many layers. It's like there are times where I just want to go, did they just choose that because it looked pretty? Or is there...
I think there's definitely both. I think there are things that just look pretty. And then I think there's probably, it's like an animation character sheet. They will be seen in these colors. They will be doing these types of things. So when you put them in colors, you know, I don't think they're looking at every costume and saying, okay, no, it needs to be a little different. They're probably just saying, okay, this is the type of costume we can go with. These are the types of colors we can go with. And then let the costume designer run with whatever they feel metaphorically fits the sequences. Mm-hmm. But Bella continuing to be in white does emphasize the angelic part. And she's sort of being the martyr. She's taking this on for Jack. He doesn't need to know about it. He doesn't need to deal with it.
Right.
She even excuses the cancer.
Yes.
By saying it was just doing its job, trying to build a liver. was trying to build it in my lungs, but it was trying to build a liver.
Yeah. She does. Everything about her always seems to be that she doesn't want to be a barrier to anything, especially to Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And she keeps trying to sort of stay out of everybody's way. And it's interesting because when you first encounter any tension in their relationship, you kind of get the impression that maybe she was going to be the bad guy in this. Mm-hmm. And then she goes to these therapy meetings, and the only thing she could be accused of is that she's trying to protect him too much.
Yeah.
That she wants everything. She doesn't want anything to change. She doesn't want him to be stressed out at work because he's already stressed out and overworked by thinking about her problems. But she doesn't foresee the greater problem of not telling him that that it would be a greater burden later on.
Because suddenly she won't feel fine anymore she'll feel fine until the moment she doesn't.
You exactly. Hannibal says that you feel good until the precise moment that you don't.
And at what point is she planning to tell him? Or do you get the feeling that she's planning to tell him when he won't insist she fight?
Probably. Usually
let it go far enough. Right. So it just absolutely...
There's no way he could force her hand or insist or...
Well, she said at the end about when she was going to plan on telling him.
What did she say?
Her plan was when it was something she couldn't hide anymore, basically.
So it was when the moment she doesn't feel okay anymore.
Well, I mean, I'm sure she would have hid the nausea and the vomiting as far as she could. She basically wanted the facade to last as long as possible until Jack got smart enough, essentially.
She says the reason why she doesn't want to, she didn't want to do all that. She wanted things to stay normal.
For as long as they possibly could.
Right.
Because she knows she's on her way out.
As things change, it's going to change quick, fast, and be completely out of her control.
Yeah.
And that led to this beautiful realization that we talked about, the performance from Lawrence Fishburne, who has up until now been the bad guy.
Very heavy.
To play that realization in this scene that's not even about him. The scene is about something else. So to couch that in there is just this lovely moment of silent acting. And he does a tremendous job.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's true. Not a word. We watch his realization bloom.
Mm-hmm.
Right in front.
So one of the things I wanted to mention about the color of white, that she's portrayed in white is also sterile and clinical.
That's true.
Yeah.
She is definitely taking, until we see her break down, she's taking almost a very clinical doctor mentality to having the cancer. You could tie the white back to the conversation about having it be too late for her to have kids, because that's also a different form of sterile.
That's true.
Where it's a lack of emotion, also a lack of being able to have children anymore, a lack of much, much more in her future other than a hospital bed.
Yes.
And most hospitals being stark white, they use white linens, doctors are in white lab coats. The white can be a clinical sort of sterile environment, which is what she has in her future after the diagnosis of stage 4.
So it could just be an entirely metaphorical costume.
As is everything.
Yes, angels, scarily,
well,
clinical.
We wrap this story up, this episode, with a really nice scene between Jack and Bella in Hannibal's office. Jack, again, is in the exit room. And you sort of sense Hannibal's irritation. But then you can have the office. And he gives it to them to have their moment. And it is a moment where you do feel the genuine affection in Hannibal.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are these momentary scenes. Don't be ashamed to go after more wine. There are these momentary scenes in these episodes where you do see the person that is in Hannibal. You know, in general, he's a lot of phony.
Yes.
And he's very good at being phony. But you do see these moments of personhood. Jack's scene here with Bella, you know, where she's still trying to not have the conversation. And Jack and, you know, we're having the conversation. We're having it right now. But
she looks at him and she's like, you know.
He's not playing it. You know, we're so used to seeing Jack, when he's not getting his way, play the power card.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And
the principle.
He's playing a power card while at the same time being incredibly emotionally vulnerable.
Mm.
So he plays it within.
He has something different at stake here, though, yeah. I think. It's a different relationship. I think as a boss, he has his one way of relating to people. And although a lot of people who are bosses can also be that way when they go home, but it's sort of refreshing to see that in his relationship with his wife, he doesn't extend that same behavior the way he behaves with underlings mm-hmm. than he does with his wife. He turns all of that down, and it definitely becomes more about what she needs. And quite possibly they could have sat there and not had conversations about things because they're being too nice to each other mm-hmm. and not want, oh, that person's busy. Oh, I don't want to bring that. Oh, no, she worked too many hours. Oh, he's really, you know, they're constantly sort of sheltering each other to the point where it made it easy for her to hide in that shelter, to hide this, mm-hmm. this truth. But now she can't hide anymore, but he's still trying to be very gentle about it. And trying to lure, you know, get her, you know, to come out. We have to talk about this now at this point.
Let's talk about the other person with cancer in the episode.
Okay.
Our killer of the week. Who in this episode almost entirely exists to be a metaphor for everything else in the episode.
We've established through the text that the killer has a tumor or has mm-hmm. some kind of cancer. And so they kind of know, they kind of have an idea. They didn't right away. They misdiagnosed it at the beginning. Then they talked to
When they were in the lab.
Yeah.
We looked up what was in his vomit.
Exactly.
And it was chemotherapy.
Because at first they thought it was just him, you know, not being able to handle what he did or some kind of fear, which seemed
Will
silly
said,
to us.
No.
Yes. And well,
absolutely
yeah.
not. He's righteous in what he does. He wouldn't be at all uncertain.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't get grossed out by what he had done.
Exactly. There
and then they pointed out the fact that madness slept here. So he's saying, no, this guy slept fine. It wasn't anything that was caused by him being unrestful based on the crimes he had committed. It was something completely different.
He sees people on fire, which is...
He's allowing them to
one of the first really cool bits of crazy imagery in the show.
Which has more significance than just, I'm going to pick them. Because we see him walk past a group, a family.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he sees them perfectly normal. They are not on fire.
And they come
so,
down. They go
so theoretically, he actually
can see
the
guilt.
Sin. And the guilt. Yeah. Because the first couple are murder...
He's a rapist.
He's a rapist,
and she likes to watch.
And
yes,
she likes
right.
to watch. He sees something, some kind of guilt.
Something within it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we see him looking at a number of other people also later in the episode.
Totally
and he
normal.
Doesn't see the flaming
He sees
heads.
All those people in the alleyway. He sees mm-hmm. the homeless person. Essentially,
yeah.
He sees the security
yeah.
guard.
He sees the homeless person, and then he sees the security guard.
And the security
and
guard
like,
is on fire.
And that's
yep.
the person. So the killer of the week, the first case we get is in this hotel room where the killer slept while being guarded by two angels. So two people on their knees with their back skinned and then strung up to the ceiling. And this was the first tableau that felt like the rest of the Hannibal Lecter stories to me. And I think it's because the second tableau in this episode is the security guard strung up in the alley. And that looks so much like the Silence of the Lambs security guard hung up after the escape. And it brought up this idea that killers are doing things that are not possible.
Mm.
And this is something that only gets more extreme throughout the series.
Oh, the styles of deaths
yeah.
are almost impossible. Physically, it seems not possible to do
yeah.
what he did. Because they have hooks in them and line, and there's, I guess, D-rings or something in the walls. It's pretty elaborate. How would you actually
accomplish
this?
And how would you accomplish this without anyone noticing? How would you accomplish this in a what looks like a rundown hotel with probably very thin walls, and you'd right. need a power drill, mm-hmm. you'd need all these things.
You'd be making some noise. And so, there would be a lot of blood.
It brings up a few different things. So Hannibal, the series, could take place in this sort of alternate world where these things happen and can be done. We can accept that and move on.
Right.
And I think that's what most people just accept and move on. But what always struck me as interesting while we're watching this and while we're seeing these tableaus is something that Jonathan Demme said about Silence of the Lambs. He said that guard strung up with the American flags behind him and with the fog and with... That wasn't what was actually there. That was what was seen by the first guy into the room. So he will be haunted by the image of that first glimpse. You know, when you first see something horrifying, it's horrifying.
Right.
And if you don't see it again, if you don't take detailed mental images of it, all you see is this weird, heightened version of what was actually there.
So your brain has kind of made it more horrific yeah. than it really is.
And so if that's something, and I think Brian Fuller's the kind of guy who would design with the intentions of another director for another part of the Hannibal mythos in mind. He would design this not only based on Thomas Harris, not only based on the other movies, but just with this overall aesthetic. And so I think that's what we're starting to see here.
And I think also you have to kind of prop up the window of disbelief in a long-term
in
series.
General, yes.
Because you have to keep it interesting. And maybe it might be a choice to not limit themselves to, you know, things being physically possible, because they want to use their imagination and come up with some wild and crazy stuff. And it's been nice that science-wise, they have been rather truthful compared to, because we've discussed this before, how the CSIs and all, they throw all that stuff out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And they come up with their own version of forensic science, which is nothing like real life. And they seem to be trying...
They enhance things a lot.
Yes. They're trying to do that here in more... honest, this is really how we do it thing. And what is a little, more imaginative are the actual deaths themselves. Like, you can't sit there and think about it too long, because then you find all the holes in it. But it is stunning to look at. You know, that the imagery of them opening, and they prepare us for it through their dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is, when Jack tells Will, prepare yourself.
This
is, you know.
This is going to be bad.
This is going to be bad. You know, this is going to be worse than, and they, you go in, and what I find kind of interesting about it is it's sort of horrific and beautiful at the same time. The way they lit it, and the way they're artfully sort of strung up. And their hands in that prayer pose, and there's sort of a soft light on them, so you can't. They're nude, so they're trying to cover up.
Well,
things there.
The nudity is a funny thing, because we watched the Blu-ray, and the Blu-ray is the producer's cut mm-hmm. of the episode, which pretty much means it's the original cut that was delivered to NBC, and NBC said you can't show butts. You just can.
You can show.
And so their solution,
flayed backs,
was to increase the amount of blood on the backs of these victims. So instead of seeing two distinct buttocks, you see this weird hazy mess of bloodiness.
Right.
Which
is so odd, because you see torn flesh, you see open rib cage.
Yeah.
You see.
And I don't want it to sound like we're complaining.
No.
Because we're happy
yeah.
that Hannibal is willing to show us these grotesque things.
Exactly. But I just find it interesting, though, that you can show all of that, but we can't. We're extremely worried about showing the buttocks.
Yes.
Two distinct.
Now later.
No butt crack.
When
allowed.
They pick up the balls.
Yes, which we can very...
Well, that was,
but they talk
that was
around
trimmed
it.
Significantly in the
oh,
TV
Oh, it was.
Cut.
Okay.
So, I mean, in that sequence, that's obvious. Yeah. It's instead of the close-up shot,
yeah,
it's just a wide shot.
The wide shot, I see.
In the TV
edit. Okay. which I find really funny that everyone dances around that too. No one seems to not even want to say the word testicles at this point.
I bet most of the NBC people didn't even know what was going on. They weren't paying enough attention.
They really
so that's why they didn't say
that
it.
One. Yeah, they used a lot of metaphors, and it was funny. You know, they kind of used humor a little bit to just, I guess, soften, because it's definitely a bloody piece of, you know, body part there. But they do kind of soften it with them kind of making the vague references more like a funny reference on there.
And this second tableau in this alleyway offers some of the most striking visuals of the entire episode.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the way it's lit.
Yes, when Jack walks away after Will has snapped at him, for a moment it looked like Jack's face showed a bit of guilt.
Like, I think Jack probably felt bad.
He felt like, okay, I'm seeing that Jack, or that Will is cracking. Jack can see that Will's obviously not behaving like his normal self.
Do you think Jack has been able to convince himself
that up
Will
until this
fine.
Point, that Will,
you know,
has
Will's
been fine.
He's okay. He's
fine.
Really okay.
He's not disturbed.
Yeah.
And then he kind of feels like he's broken him at that point, and he walks away, and as the sort of camera pulls back, you get this long view.
A beautiful shot.
It's beautiful.
Backlit behind Will's head. Yeah. It has a halo. Behind the victim is a halo. But it's all black, no detail.
Yeah, exactly.
And we see Jack slowly walking, also cast in shadow. We can see no definition of Jack, no definition of the Vic or of
Will. All the light is illuminating from these unknown sources in this back alley.
From behind,
I mean,
this
could very well be very artsy FBI lighting. You know, they've come, they've set up the big lights very nicely. You know, maybe Jack asked them to show some respect for the beauty of the tableau.
I don't know.
Probably
Jack,
not. Maybe Jack didn't
Jack,
ask them.
I don't think Jack
maybe Will
beauty.
Said,
Will
see Will the
might've.
Beauty of the tableau.
But it is rather interesting that it's that, you know, that sort of that translucent drop behind them. And then they've got, like, this gigantic light right behind the victim. So there is a bright, sun-like light above. The victim is haloed in light, looking even more like an angel. And then you have Will down below looking up.
Almost like he's praying.
The perfectly placed only other light right behind his head. So it has that, those old, paintings of, you know, religious paintings, like from Illuminations and stuff like that, where everyone has sort of like the gold.
Yes,
frame.
The big halo.
Yeah. It definitely kind of looked like that. It sort of had an old biblical illumination sort of quality, to it. You know, like it was a religious painting.
It also felt a lot like those millennial supernatural horror movies.
It
you
did,
know, like
yeah. The 90s.
Like Fallen
stuff,
and End of Days. Everything had that weird drab sort of brownish tones to it. And
lots of,
the over
sepia tones and
so that shot specifically, that could have been the poster for this serial killer movie that we'd be watching.
I could totally see that. Most definitely. Could totally see that. But it's you know, interesting, the whole the tableau of angels. I love that when Will does his back walk thing, he asks for plastic to be put on the bed because he wants to lay on the bed.
Because he wants to
the way
be
the killer
exactly
did.
The way the killer did.
And, you know, coming up with the idea that, you know, when he looks at these people, you know, he knows this is not who you are. This is my gift to you, that, you know, that he's, you know, you are meant to be angels. That in his journey towards death, that he is trying to make these people who apparently have some kind of sin that he sees find some sort of ascendance and or transformation.
Do you think Will's perception of the killers is changing as he loses himself? Do you think he's losing his objectivity?
Oh, most definitely.
because he's talking about, I mean, there's a moment where he talks about how the killer's mind has turned against him and there's no one here to help. And then later in the episode, he's talking with Beverly Katz, and he asks if he seems different. And again, later, he talks about how he dreams more than he used to. And Hannibal has to tell him, he tells him, you're not unlike this killer. And Will says his brain is playing tricks on him. So Will is seeing the same things in this killer as he sees in himself. And so I think it makes you wonder if he's actually seeing the similarities or if he's projecting the similarities on something that is more of a blank slate than he actually thinks. If he looks at a black screen and sees a slightly darker black, is he putting that there or is that actually there?
Whereas the connections are not really there, but he is almost constructing connection.
That's what I'm wondering.
I think this is something we need to think of as we go further down
the road. It's worth observing that tendency. Because
there's definitely a lot of, especially since he has that weird confrontation with the killer at the end.
And let's talk about that.
Yes.
Because that's odd. And, I mean, the killer's death comes at 34 minutes into the episode. You know, we've seen the killer show up 20 minutes in.
Yes.
And then be there for the climax. This killer shows
up completely different in
the cold open and then disappears significantly before the end of the episode. The killer is found hung up in a barn with his own set of angel wings.
Which we still can't figure out how one would do to yourself.
Well, that's the big question.
Also, how did he stem himself from bleeding to death when he tried to make himself angelic?
Very true. I mean, there's a lot of problems with this. And this is, you know, I think this is a really well-constructed episode. And I think that this is one of the first episodes where the killer of the week does not overshadow the actual legitimate content. And the killer of the week is rather interesting.
Mm-hmm. And almost pulled out of fantasy here. Because we have not just somebody who could be a vigilante. We have somebody who has no way of knowing the past of the...
But may actually know it.
But somehow can see that they are guilty of some sort of crime, and he's giving them a chance to redeem themselves by becoming the angels who watch over him while he sleeps. And then he turns himself into an angel, where Jack actually says, or not Jack, Will says that it was his choice and his manner of choosing in his way to die, which I thought was interesting because... Jack just having found out Bella is being affected by cancer, and
so
he does not
have... So is Jack no longer objective either in this episode?
No. Jack is not objective. I don't think
so at all. That's really interesting.
I don't believe so. I think that it kind of... I don't know. It was hard to pinpoint where Jack falls, but I know I saw where Will fell, where he was, you know, making the comments about... he's afraid, he's scared, he doesn't want to die, he knows that his mind is, you know, out of his control, and he doesn't know what to do, which is exactly what Will's going through. But I don't know where Jack loses objectivity. It's not as clear.
Right.
But I know when they walk to that farm, Jack is still in a haze after realizing what Bella has, because at that point, he has not had the conversation with Bella yet.
Right, yeah.
So he's still mulling that over in his mind, like, oh shit, my wife has cancer.
How do I deal with that?
How do I deal with that? What am I going to do with this information? And so when he sees the killer hung up as a victim of his, you know, his own suicide, and he hears Will say that, there is a moment of, you know, Jack realizing, oh, well, shit, she doesn't have that.
Yeah.
She doesn't have that choice of how she dies. She's like him. She's going to be losing control of her faculties and going to be looking for that sort of solace.
It also might be a moment of fear of what if at some point in her struggle Bella does decide, I've had enough.
What is he going to do with that?
Yeah. What, you know, that suddenly there presents yet another option. that here's someone so desperate in their struggle with cancer that they decide to end it before the cancer decides to end it. That's got to be a frightening moment, knowing that that there's all
that could happen at any time.
It presents itself.
And he wouldn't be able to legitimately tell her why she shouldn't.
Right.
And he knows that, so he's got this extra helpless feeling. And I don't think Jack Crawford is the kind of guy who feels helpless.
He does not. And he doesn't he doesn't handle it very well.
No.
Because you can see he does the right back at you, Will. He gets very snappy. You see Will begging, trying to get out of it. He said, I can't do this anymore. It's harder and harder for me to look. This is bad for me. And Jack is just like, well, I'm not your father.
Yeah.
Like,
walk away if you want. But you're not going to like it.
I could care less, essentially. And, you know, I'm not your boss. You want to quit? Quit. Whatever. What is it to me?
It's a very petulant child reaction
to it. It was.
Like, fine. Just go.
Oh, yeah.
Just go.
Exactly. You'll just have to live with the consequences of what you do.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And then it's the part where you were really, I think, trying to get to. The part where it's all fantastical.
Yeah,
the
killer
appears
behind Will. Oh, so Jack
Lee. Well, first of all, how does he get himself up there, break his own ribs, give himself his own wings?
There's a lot that's problematic in the killer's death.
Because it is so artful. And like you were talking about the bodies that we find in the hotel.
Like it would have been
a mess.
It would have been wonderful, actually, to see him trying to do it and failing. It would have been wonderful to see him like attempting to, and then Jack and Will are like, he tried to make himself an angel and couldn't do it.
Or even see him failing, like see him dead, but having failed. And
having failed,
right. Or even have been able to sort of do the back
of it or half
playing,
of it. Yeah.
But he's not suspended.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the second victim was suspended, but the first ones weren't.
Yeah.
Not only
they were kneeling.
And there's a moment where the lab geeks say that they found histamine in the tissue, so she was alive in the hotel room for being skinned.
Yeah.
So she was in the praying position, which I thought was interesting, so we don't see them being gagged at all. Would she not have been making lots of noise being hung up skinned?
Could he have just drugged her completely and...
Okay, yeah.
That's possible.
Coma?
They were
alive, but they weren't necessarily...
They did have an anesthetic.
Okay.
Yeah. They had an anesthetic in the scotch glasses.
And I think they're also by having the woman stay alive, and this has happened before, is it's kind of echoing the book a little bit.
Keeping Mrs.
Yes.
Leeds
Mrs. Leeds stayed alive.
Well,
so
that brings us to the most obvious echo of the book of Red Dragon, which is the angel maker who has somehow come down from his angel perch at the end and is behind Will for a jump scare, essentially.
Yes.
I mean, it's the cheapest moment in this episode. But he talks about how he can make Will see the majesty of his becoming, which is so Francis Dolarhyde.
I can give you the magic of your
and
becoming.
So the biggest cheat. Mm-hmm. Okay, because the end of this scene is Will alone in the barn.
Yes, yes.
So, clearly this is meant to be imaginary. But if it's meant to be imaginary, how on earth does Will know that he is being seen with a flaming head?
Yes.
Yeah.
How does he know that this killer had flaming heads? Now, what's fascinating, I mean, all of this is the worst part of the episode, hands down. This part should have been rethought. But in the script, it actually happens. The killer actually comes down.
Actually,
it doesn't say how.
That would have made more sense.
But it doesn't say how.
Yeah. Even though we don't even know how he got himself.
How he could have gotten himself up. How he could have gotten himself back down. It's so cheap.
And
so
pointless.
But he comes down and then he falls over at the end. So he dies then.
He's dead. I would have accepted that more than what they changed.
I think that would have just irritated me.
Really?
No, I think it just would have pissed me off.
Because it really bothered me that it was like a hallucination. That, to me, seems like more of a cheat. That, it's all
in his mind.
Let's
just agree that both of the demise of this killer...
Cheat and
cheat.
Everything about it is cheat.
Shame on you, Brian Fuller. Shame on you.
And a lot of it could be, it looks cool...
Yes.
It looks really cool, and it's really creepy, and you get to do the boo, you know, thing with the character. And then you get to do basically a little bit of exposition for the
and
rest.
It's also that Will's body journey horror thing. You know, a lot of horror movies that involve skinning and people you think are dead like to throw that, oh my God, they're actually still alive. Think of how horrible that would be. And so it feels like that's the I mean, it's a gag. It's a horror film gag that they're doing there. And so that's where they're going with it. They just did it incredibly poorly.
Yeah. But if it's imaginary, there's an interesting back and forth that happens in that conversation while Will is being seen as a flaming head. He says, I can bring it out of you. And Will says, not all the way out. So it's an acknowledgement inside Will's imagination of himself that he has some characteristic of these felons inside him that could not ever be purged, no matter what. Not even by this angel maker who is redeeming all of these criminals.
And I guess you could say that that just because we see him as in flames is necessarily the way he's seeing himself. Mm-hmm. It could be just a visual shorthand because we know what that means.
And that is something that the creators of the show have said they do. They don't necessarily show us what Will sees. So like in series 2, when Will sees the creature that we've dubbed the Wendigo, we don't believe Will is actually seeing that.
Oh, of course not. We also don't believe
Will
that
is seeing something that's making him think in this direction. So it is a shorthand, and it just felt really cheap to me in this episode.
Yeah.
They haven't gotten the handle on how to do it yet.
Considering there is so much going on elsewhere.
There are times, though, I do believe he's actually seeing the Wendigo.
Oh, I think so, too.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah, we haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, we haven't got there.
Okay?
Looking at Miko's face, listeners, she is very intrigued about the Wendigo. Yeah.
Spoiler!
I know, I'm like, stop talking about this. I'm not supposed to know.
No, I won't give you the premise.
There's a lot of Stephen King stuff going on here. We'll move beyond.
So I want to mention Brian Reitzel's score in this episode. He's pulling away from melody. In the first several episodes, we're still feeling a lot of melody. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's most interesting about Brian Reitzel's score throughout the series is it's very just tone-based and mood-based rather than melody-based like a lot of score. And so this is one of the first episodes where I really noticed him doing a lot of that, where it was just a lot of, here's some tone, and it's not doing anything, it's just sitting there.
What's nice
and
is
making
that
you uncomfortable.
It doesn't overwhelm anything. Half the time I don't even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just happening, it's triggering my subconscious.
Really,
but I don't
you
really
notice it when it is a melody at this point. And because his melodies are beautiful, but when it's not a melody, it's doing the same thing as what I've always called the Lynchian hum.
Yeah.
It's that weird subwoofer hum that he's got. And it just makes you so incredibly uncomfortable.
Exactly.
And so a lot of this music does that, which is really something else.
There's great sound design in this movie. Just every little bit of it. Again, we were talking about the layering again. There's so much here to digest.
There is.
It's beautiful the way they kind of put it all together in a subtle way. Like I said, I don't really notice the music, but I know that it's manipulating me emotionally and everything during.
It's winning.
Well, not just that, but biologically, because if you are heightened and you are uncomfortable, you're going to have more adrenaline in your system. So you're going to be triggered, like with the Lynchian hum, to be sort of on the edge of your seat. And heightened awareness and, like, ready with your flight or fight sort of reaction inside your body, making you, like, you know, seriously on the edge of your seat. That's not... They're really trying to reel you in, and then when the actual episode is over, you're left with this, how do I go back to real life?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you do need, like, a while afterwards to, like, think about what you
For all of our listeners, I would just like to say, please do not watch Hannibal
immediately before bed.
Multiple episodes before going to bed. Yes. The nightmares.
It will mess with you.
I have had with the psychosomatic pain the next morning. It has been awful. So just don't do it.
It's a little PSA.
There you go. This is
Something funny. Maybe.
Yeah. Always. We would counteract it with a little Archer, a little Arrested Development afterwards.
Yeah.
Which then to me usually just combine the two in my dreams. So Job was having weird, intense discussions with Hannibal. And,
oh, that's all.
And
kinds
the Wendigo was wandering around going, "Go, go, 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 go." So let's.
Chicken?
Wait.
Has family ever seen a chicken?
This episode's not over yet.
No, it's not.
We're digressing.
That's what it was.
Because we still have the end of the episode. Okay. That's true.
So we end this episode with Jack having just had this intense conversation with Bella, sitting alone in his office. Mm-hmm. Will comes in and says, "I'm going to sit here until you're ready to talk. You don't have to say a word until you're ready." And then just sits there.
Well, basically, he's not leaving until Jack talks. Yeah.
We are going to talk about this, Jack.
It's going to be whenever you get around to it.
He gets the defensive cold shoulder first.
He does, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jack says, "What do you want, Will? Just, I'm done with you. You've already said you're going to walk out on me." He already said, "I'm dealing with my wife not talking to me. I'm not going to deal with you not talking to me now." And so he feels like Jack feels that Will has abandoned him. Mm-hmm. So he's like, "Whatever, what do you want?" And then for Will to counter that with
emotion.
Not just his emotion, but his loyalty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very much like a dog who knows that something is wrong with you. Yeah. He sits and he says that he's going to stay there until he's ready to interact.
Very true.
Well done.
Very true.
That was good.
The promise that humans cannot.
Yes, absolutely. That's awesome.
He's going to come with that promise that humans cannot, and it's true.
And it ends in that. It ends in that wonderful graduate.
Oh
type
yeah.
Way where we go with a pullback shot.
Two chairs.
Of them just looking forward, and I remember noting that the office is bright orange.
Harvest gold.
Yeah, it's this other color that we haven't seen on the show.
Very different from every other location we've been in, and it kept driving me crazy because I kept going, "It's not orange, it's not." And then 3/4 of the way through, my brain just went, "It's harvest gold." It's that 70s, and there's a lot of it in mid-century furniture, too, where it's with warm, like, beach-colored furniture, and that it's gold, but it's a very warm, earth-tone gold. It's not a metallic gold.
And what they're sharing is a very human moment. It is unlike the rest of the imagery that we're seeing, which is very otherworldly. Underworld, we have all these dark images, but this is actually like an actual human interaction that is not really being influenced by any of those darker tones or those the insidious sort of sapphire.
Everything else is kind of
Hannibal's
cold
table.
And scary, whereas Jack's office is warm and it is also fall.
We are making a transition to another
season.
Yeah,
so it's sort of interesting that while it's much warmer than everything else we've seen, it's also that it's the color of the leaves that we're seeing. It's an end of the season kind of color is going on in there. In a time where we get to see Jack at his most vulnerable in his office, we get to see a color that is warm and vulnerable, which is... something that we haven't
seen. It also brings up that Bella in white is the impending winter.
Wow.
Which we're seeing the transition into winter.
We're heading into it.
And
is a death of a lot of things.
And this show spends a lot of time in winter.
Oh, interesting.
And so and that also goes with the blues.
You know,
very much winter cold tones.
Because all of that is very cold, even with the reds that are incorporated in it. Mm-hmm. Because the reds are kind of maroon, they're purpley reds. It's still very cold.
Yeah.
Most definitely. That office was about the warmest thing we've seen in this entire episode, our entire season so far. usually not even Will's world is that warm.
His is much more dull.
It's
and
taupes and yeah,
or even just the green, the
it's
hunter
dull,
green.
Yeah, exactly. It's earth tones.
Trees in his area, mm-hmm. the bushes of his area, his house sort of just kind of blends into the landscape almost.
Right. His colors are very utilitarian and sort of very bland. Where to have those intense colors in a different.
You can imagine Will accidentally being shot in many a hunting trip.
Yes,
because he just sort of
because he blends in with everything
with his own homemade camo. Yeah.
It's interesting to talk about how dense and layered, especially in that dining room scene, is. Because it's sort of how dense and layered the meal is mm-hmm. and how complicated everything is that Hannibal is, constructing to put on the table. Because that's basically what the show is doing. And it's giving you all these, these layers at the same time as you have... Hannibal leaning over and smelling Bella and coming up with this actually wonderfully complimentary sort of reason why he's doing it. He smells her cologne that smells as something sort of wild and exciting and he's being very charming. But then it sets us up later on because we now, by the time it happens, he does it to Will later mm-hmm. on. We know that he can smell cancer and he can smell... So what is it later on when Will is talking about losing himself and Hannibal kind of comes up behind him, does that really creepy sniff thing, Will also reacts to it because he can tell that it's happening.
Did you just smell me?
And he just, did shoot it and he is right out. Like, not just a subtle, Bella's like, what's going on?
Dude,
he
creeper
calls him on it.
Well,
that is
the most uncomfortably close Hannibal has been to Will so far.
Right.
And that is the moment that launched 1,000 shippers. they're all about Will and Hannibal's love affair.
Let's not get involved with the fan art you've been sending me. Oh, jeez. It's like been messing with my day.
But that moment
so
is great because it's a callback to the book where they talk about the
Hannibal's sense of
the aftershave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it
must have had a ship on the bottle.
Because he's not very complimentary. It's a type of cologne that must have a ship on the bottle.
And then what's also interesting is Hannibal is asking him about his headaches increasing. So Hannibal smells him, makes a mental note, asks him about headaches. That moment shows us something is wrong. Right.
And they don't tell us what is he sensing from that.
Right.
Because he just, kind of goes over, makes the joke
Hannibal
about...
Hannibal covers it, too.
Yeah.
Because Hannibal says, you maybe want to try a different aftershave.
Yes.
So Hannibal knows something's off.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't want to talk to Will about it.
Well, and it's not shared with us in any part of this episode, the way we kind of figure out the whole Bella thing. And it's also kind of interesting, they took it out of the book that, he says that he gets it every year. Mm-hmm. But he has a family.
For Christmas.
Yeah.
So it begs the question of who is getting aftershave.
The dogs,
Well, it would be nice if the dogs pulled their meager allowance together and bought Will some aftershave. Because I'm sure they love that smell.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure, when Will's not around, they're mowing neighbors' lawns. And they've got their newspaper route, playing poker.
But that would just pass the money around each other. They're not really going to earn any money.
Unless they have neighborhood dogs that they're luring.
Oh, yeah, they could do that.
A little tiny Easter egg in the imagery when he's being smelled is the antlers.
In the foreground.
Of the stag statue. It's right... kind of where Will's chest and heart might be, which is kind of just...
And that's the thing. Is
prongs in the shot. Yeah.
Every single part of the show to me is like a complicated meal. Like the complicated meals, that we're seeing and it's like on NBC where people are used to basically fast food. If you've had fast food, if you've had something like that all your life, you can't sometimes really get the concept of the complicated meal. Mm-hmm. And here is a show that is on a station used to giving you fast food, and they're serving you a multiple course, dense, deeply flavorful, you've got to dig around and figure out what all this stuff means show. And I'm happy mm-hmm. because... that's what the networks should be showing more of.
Oh, yes. I mean, we've had to dig for that.
Yeah.
In our fandom to find those things. And that's what, you know, brought us together with our similarities, the things that we respect and like. And, you know, this is why we're doing this podcast, is because we're like, finally!
It is.
How is this getting on TV? We're not going to question it. We're just going to keep watching.
Keep it coming.
Keep our fingers crossed and just hope they don't take it away.
And realize the more you give the audience a complicated meal, the more their palate adjusts and the more they'll want the flavorful meal and not the quick and easy. Mm-hmm. So I really hope this keeps, you know, going. I want to sit at this table in more ways.
Well, we've at least got 3 years at the table. Yeah. Another thing I realized about that stag in the office is if Hannibal... There's two ways to interpret that. And we could go back and look at earlier episodes. But if Hannibal got that after Will has told him about this stag that's been following him mentally, off camera,
haven't seen all the therapy sessions.
But it's definitely possible, with Will talking about his dreams, that he could have told Hannibal that. Or... did Hannibal have that? Will saw it in the office,
and
it combined with this dream imagery that he's got going on, and became the Raven Stag.
I'm more inclined to think it's the latter.
Yeah,
because usually that's what dreams are. They're composites of things that you have stored away in your brain from things you've experienced in your waking, and sometimes you don't even realize it. That things that you're seeing in your dream are actually cataloged there and in there because your brain has cataloged it. Mm-hmm. You may not have been conscious of it at the time. You know, and they say even people that you don't recognize in your dreams are in some way someone that you have met but you don't remember meeting. And it could be somebody you bumped into on the way out of a coffee shop.
So Will met this statue in Hannibal's office right around the time that he saw Cassie Boyle on those antlers, and it just all combined to become the Raven Stag, which is pretty cool.
His brain found an embodiment for something that it's trying to work out through the images that are already cataloged in his brain. I hope everyone else is getting as much out of it as we are. That
the fan base for this show. I mean, the fan base for the show is small.
Yeah,
we have no illusions.
No,
this show is not popular.
No. But we're rabid.
But the people who are the fanables, they rival the Browncoats for passion.
So they're people who are used to looking. Yeah, because I always think about this. It's NBC, so we're you know.
And it's NBC's death slot. Season one was on Thursday nights.
The death slot.
Season two it was on Friday.
Oh, our shows go to die.
Friday nights at 9, where if you're not going out...
Yeah, you're going to bed.
You're going to bed, yeah, really.
Exactly.
So we have an episode called Entree next week. I just wanted to put that, Miko, in your mind. We have a special guest star, three special guest stars.
Okay.
We're introducing my favorite character that we have not yet met, Dr. Frederick Chilton.
Oh, he's so slimy.
I love Chilton. He's so cool. Raul Esparza plays him. He is awesome in this show. If you want to email us, you can email us at eattherootcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at eattherootcast. Send us questions or comments. We are looking for an artist to design a logo for us. Right now, we're just using that image of Hannibal. So if any of the amazing community of Hannibal fan art would like to design a logo for us, I'm thinking a microphone with antlers would be kind of cool. Just putting that out there. We'd love submissions. Since a huge portion of our fans and the Hannibal fans are on Tumblr and Reddit, we ask you to please share our episodes on both Tumblr and Reddit and tell your friends. Thank you for joining us at the table.